Even Master himself only has so much power to fight against it. I mean, Christ, of course, is the self-realized Master, and look what a mess they made of it, and how quickly they made such a mess of it. And even first-generation disciples of Christ were fighting with each other, just the same as here. The reason we don't know it is because, you know, the groups that lost just faded away. But Paul, who was really responsible for creating Christianity, was in the same kind of battle with the other direct disciples, with James and Peter, at least so the tradition is. But part of it is factual, that Paul would go around sharing, because Jesus left the inspiration. And then Paul was the one who really explained what all of those things meant. He created traditions, he created rituals, he intuitively knew how it needed to go. He was guided by God and by his guru to do it. He was chosen by his guru, and that's the work he did. And he would go around setting up these churches, and the Jerusalem disciples, James and the others, would go after him and try to speak to the same people and try to tell them that Paul had it wrong. Ay, ay, ay. You know? And they were just in huge battles as to whether or not what Jesus brought was Judaism. That's why I've mentioned sometimes you read in Paul's letters these incredibly passionate discussions about whether you have to be circumcised to be saved. And when you read it, you think, that is a nutty discussion. Why could they? How could they possibly be having that discussion? And Paul is devoting paragraphs to it. Well, it's because the question was, did you have to be Jewish to be Christian? Because Paul had done this completely unthinkable thing, which is he'd taken it out to the heathen. And that just wasn't where anybody else was thinking. But the institutional form of Christianity, then there was a longer battle between, Swami talks, I'm going to the end of the book, but between the Gnostics and the institutional church. Now, all of that is exactly what we've been acting out again. First-generation disciples, just with really not even small differences, but profound, fundamental differences about Master's teachings. I was an early activist in the struggles against SRF, and always one of the fiercer competitors in the story. Because of the public work that I have done over so many years, I saw firsthand that it wasn't really just a question of what they were saying against Swami or anything like that. It was that they were teaching the devotees a version of self-realization which was hurting them spiritually. And that became my crusade. And what they were teaching was that you cannot contact God directly. I mean, that's not, of course, what SRF says, but that's what they have, in fact, established by making the authority of their institution so strong and making the mystique around their leaders so impenetrable that everyone else becomes secondary to it. You can't have your own inspiration. Even when Swami was there, as he quotes, Taramata said, in any organization, no one even has a right to think except the members of the board. And Swami quotes that often because of the spiritual implications of that, you see. What Master brought, what Master did specifically is he stripped away all the priesthood, all the ritual, all the dogma, all the theology, and handed us Kriya Yoga. He just handed us Kriya. And he says, now it's yours. It's up to you. You make your relationship with God, and it happens within you. And then SRF, even in this first generation, has inserted themselves as the arbiter of what is and is not true inspiration. And you see, that completely changes everything. Absolutely changes everything. My absolute favorite, when I was working on the expose website that we put up, I never managed to work this into the website, probably because God didn't want me to. I only found it toward the end, but I think God didn't want me to. It was just hack writing by some scribe in the editorial department doing the back pages of one of the latest editions of the AY. I have to say that because when Swami was putting out, back in India last month, when they were putting out God is... Conversations with Yogananda, we did the end pages at 3 a.m. And then I was sitting there with, there were three of us who collectively had the IQ of one average person, trying to just put together the last pages so we could get the disk to the printer at, before Dharma Das left for the airport at 5 a.m. So having said all that, I don't want to be like too harsh on people who write end pages for books, because you never know what was going on when they wrote them. But at the end of that, there's a section about the gurus, and it describes these gurus, this line of masters, as the spiritual protectors that, let's see, the phrasing, I have to get it almost exactly because it was important, but it was something like, you know, these gurus will guide and protect self-realization fellowship members who faithfully practice Kriya. Now, if you just read that and you think, well, okay, that's nice. But think about that for a minute. Now, what if you're a member but you don't faithfully practice Kriya? But what if you faithfully practice Kriya but you let your membership lapse? What happens in all the years before you became a member? What if you're a member for a while and then do Kriya, and then what if you don't faithfully practice Kriya? Now, all of those things, you start like that, but then somebody asks the question, and then even worse, somebody makes up an answer. And you know where you end up? The Catholic Church. Because they have been forced, you know, what happens to unbaptized babies who die before they have a chance? You know, they go to limbo, or at least they used to. Now they don't anymore. Now they go somewhere else. But for a long time they went to limbo. Little, you know, Helen Purcell, who was such a faithful Catholic, spent a great deal of her childhood praying for these poor babies in limbo because it was such a horrible place to be. But, it doesn't make any sense, but you start down a road like that and you have to answer the questions, and then once you start down a road like that, you attract people who like things like that, who are inclined to answer the questions, and pretty soon it's over. And pretty soon virtue has declined and vice has predominated, and fortunately you get another avatar, which is what we got, right? So that's what's actually been going on, and that's why this book, even though on one hand it's the most personal story Swamiji's ever written in certain ways, it also really puts out there what has been at stake and what is at stake. I sort of say has been in a sense because this book came just before, I would almost say, the tide really turned. There was a period of time when SRF was suing us and Ananda was struggling, and where the Bertolucci lawsuit was happening, you know, when the real personal, vicious personal attacks on Ananda and Swami were happening in the courts and in the newspapers, where it was just kind of tuck and nip there. There was never any real doubt that we would triumph, but we were just crawling uphill on our hands and knees, and it was a slippery slope. It was a tough climb, and you know, this came out sort of in the middle of all of that. Since that time, there's been a shift, and this what's going on in India. This is the gospel according to Asha, and I always like to make sure that you know that. But I sure had the sense when I was over there that, I felt this several years ago, but in an extremely tangible way. I just felt that Master was saying to Swami, good for you, now smooth sailing. You know, you've worked so hard. And I just felt like the energy had just been pulled away from SRF. They've had their turn, and now it's Ananda's turn. The energy shift did on Wednesday of the convocation when we were down there picketing, the day we really stood up for our rights, on that day the energy shifted. This is the gospel according to Asha. Nobody knows, has to believe that except me, but that's what it felt like. So Swamiji uses the vehicle, and this is why I want you to, I'm saying all this, because to read this book, especially those of you who've read it many times, or at least before, you get caught up in the story, and especially if you listen to it on tape, which I highly recommend. If you have never heard or don't have the audio version of it, Swami recorded it. And this book of all books is really something to hear it in his own voice, because it's so much his story. It's just something that comes across that's really extraordinary. But he interlaces with this whole story all the principles. And that's why it's so odd, because this a place called Ananda, which is about Ananda, which was founded in 1968, ends about 1972. And he tells almost nothing about Ananda. The entire story is his struggle with SRF. And you think, but excuse me, sir, I thought this was a book about Ananda. But in an odd sort of way it is, because by the time he'd started Ananda, he'd had all these experiences that completely set the pattern. And then all he's done since then, which is no small thing with the help of a lot of his friends, is manifest it. But he's never had to question what that pattern was. It was always just perfectly clear because of all these experiences. Because having experienced it firsthand and lived through all this reality of the potential of institutional religion, when he got to Ananda, he knew just what it was supposed to be. And he also had this force of... I don't know how... I can't say how conscious it was, but it was certainly deeper than conscious with him, that it was really up to him. He wasn't willing to say that until very recently, that, as he puts it, that he was always master's ace in the hole, is how he put it. Master was confident because he knew he had Swami in his back pocket, that whatever happened with SRF didn't matter because there was always Swami in his back pocket, and Swami was going to save it. You know, if they didn't get it, then Swami was going to save it. Or, more true, he always knew from the beginning that it would be Swami who would do it. So Swamiji has actually said to us that he wants the people of Ananda to study this book. Which, you know, is sort of an odd thing because you don't think of it as a study book. You think of it as a good read. But when you read it with the thought that he wants you to study it, you see how on every page he's put forward fundamental principles that we really need to grasp. Because Swami's 78, and he's already over in India, and he's not coming back to America this year. You know, it's almost over from the point of view of him being able personally to keep us in line. Oh, I know what I wanted to say, one last point about this. Because it's, on one hand, this whole struggle that I'm describing has been an external one, you know, manifested by SRF and Ananda. But the reason that this is such a karmic inclination to take these high, elevated teachings and reduce them down to something that we can grasp is because that's an enormous human tendency. We're always wanting to take that which is free and undefined and then make it small enough for us to understand it. People do it constantly. I mean, we all do it constantly. And so even if we have this sort of idea in our mind, we're always wanting to fix things. Set things in a certain way. It's much more comfortable. We can go subconscious then. We feel more secure. It gives us the impression that we have control over things. And Ananda is entering a very dangerous period in our history because we're having a modicum of success and we're of an age where it's the stage of life in which people like settle down. Somebody told me, now I can't even remember who it was, but it was some well-known spiritual leader who was reputed to have always tried to keep his organization on the verge of bankruptcy, Shivananda, because he thought it was safer if they were on the verge of bankruptcy, because then they would never have the opportunity to just relax and sort of take it for what it is. Swamiji has always made the statement, which we haven't yet had a chance to experience, that... financial success would be the greatest test that Ananda ever faces, because then we will really stand a real chance of destroying what we have. Because what will happen is that we will just lower the bar and lower the bar and become more and more concerned about things other than the reality of what the spiritual path is. And so we need to watch. We need to watch all of that, and that's why we have to know this story. Not because we know Taramata and Rajasi and Dhyamata and what happened in the Delhi Project. I mean, that's all interesting. It's very interesting. But it's really interesting because of the principles involved and the universality of those principles and the inclination of those to manifest in our own lives. That through the years of working with Ananda, and especially in the years that we've been here, David and I, which is, you know, now so much of our lives, it's like there is no other reality. It's now crossed. We've been here more than we've ever been anywhere else. I mean, I've had this great history. I've lived in two places, okay? But I've lived in Palo Alto now longer than I ever lived at Ananda Village. But the process of creating this reality has taken effort, there's no doubt about it. But it's not been difficult in the sense that it's never been confusing. Well, to be more accurate, seldom been confusing. because the principles have been so clear that you just have to, sometimes you have to take a few minutes and try to remember what principles involved here. But as soon as you remember it, you know just which way to go on it. And that's partly, and very truly, because for so many years I heard Swami talk about SRF over and over and over and over and over and over and over again until I began to recognize it. I mean, just a very simple example. You know, he talked about one of the things that happens to institutions is saints are inconvenient. People who are spiritually minded are not always that efficient. And you sort of reach a point where you begin to think that somebody efficient would be better than somebody who's very spiritual. And you start thinking, oh, well, you know, we just need somebody who can do that job. And you start thinking of qualifications in worldly terms. And it's so easy, and I've watched it many times. You know, we have two or three people, and one may have a tremendously inspiring nature but not be very effective. And then you watch yourself wanting to choose the more, of quote, effective person. But then once you start making decisions, it's not also that competent people who might not have such the karma to be as elevated in their nature don't have a place. Everybody has a place. But it's just more watching the mind to begin to choose a certain kind of reality, and that reality is always to bring things down to a more efficient level. Swamiji, that's just... And also the tendency to become confused about what you're actually doing. Swamiji writes about that, about the SRF Board of Directors became more and more thinking about how to develop Mount Washington itself, and he used the exact example later in this book. They began to think they were serving Master just as much by ordering a carton of toilet paper for the upstairs bathrooms as somebody who was going out introducing hundreds of people to Kriya Yoga. Now, yes, even a leaf, if offered with devotion, picking up a stick of grass with true inspiration is better than doing anything without that sense of inspiration. But still, let's get real about it. And so sometimes you watch the energy just circle around and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. All of those examples are in this book. Or we watch it in our own life. We become obsessed about little things and we persuade ourselves that those little things actually have something to do with our spiritual life. You know, when they don't. It's all in this book. Okay, so are there any comments or questions or thoughts before we just start with it? I feel like this book, that it's a bit like working with the Christian Bible. Once you understand what Jesus means by I, you can read the whole Bible and understand it. But until you understand that, the Bible is very confusing. It's sort of like until you understand what he's really trying to accomplish here, you can kind of read the book and miss the point. I think this is just a history of SRF and Ananda. Okay. Comments or questions? One thing that's interesting about Swamiji, so this is more personal than most books that Swami have written, but it's hardly that personal. He makes this in the introduction, he makes this reference to Scott Meredith, the literary agent to whom he sent the original manuscript of The Path. When he first wrote The Path, the intention was probably that we were going to publish it ourselves, but he also had this thought that maybe he would sell it to a major publisher who could distribute it more. And we did send it to Scott Meredith's company. Scott Meredith was a well-known agent, and the letter came back as if it were written by him, but I doubt if it was. It's probably written by someone else. And it was so New York scornful of what Swami had written, you know, and just didn't understand the more impersonal tone that Swamiji had taken in that book. You know, he didn't speak of his own anguishes about much of anything. And Swamiji himself considered, as he writes, you know, that the path was really... He said every story that he included, he only included stories that in and of themselves represented something. He didn't tell any story that was just about him. This he describes as more personal because it's really also, this was also really necessary. Part of what he's doing in this book is standing up for himself. You know, he's just really, I'm going to tell you the story as I know it, because SRF tried for so many years to suppress the story. So he just figured, I'll put every single thing out there that there is to say, and then after that, people can make up their own minds. Also, this book itself, you see, is the epitome of Ananda. It's a gesture of respect. This is the way he's always been, which is you just give everybody the information, and then they decide. Well, that's in all the controversies we've had, that's how we've always done it. Here are the facts as we know them. You know, you're a smart man, you're a smart woman, you figure it out. Well, instead of us telling you what the right conclusions are, we'll just tell you the story as we see it, and then you make up your mind, and that's why he published this also.